All right, we'll go into the home stretch now. Back to JF versus DF, the decision that's permeated our discussion by Justice Dollinger. It warrants reading multiple times. There is a trove of information in here. It's a virtual primer on expert testimony from a practical perspective of what you want your expert witnesses to do and not do. Very, very instructive. Father is claiming mom has alienated the three daughters, ages 7, 13, and 15. To support his position in the case, he brings on board three very prominent, nationally prominent expert witnesses. I'll put experts in quotes, all right, to come in and support his position. Amy Baker, who is a sort of researcher, Linda Gottlieb, who is a social worker, and Robert Evans, who I believe is a psychologist. They're dad's witnesses. First lesson, more is not necessarily better than less. It's not a question of how many people you can get coming out of your clown car at the courthouse, all right? In this case, dad has three expert witnesses. Mother has one rebuttal witness, a psychologist by the name of Peter Favero from Long Island, all right? The court goes through the testimony. Now, the father, I don't know, I don't have any specific back channel knowledge, but just knowing who those three people are, he has spent thousands, probably tens of thousands of dollars to have that lineup of those three in that courthouse. This is how the judge described their testimony, right? Devoid of any practical significance, almost sophomoric quality, psychological circumlocution, unrealistic and Pollyannish, reaching the apex of foolishness. How would you like to spend a ton of money on experts and read that in the decision? All right. The court, in analyzing and dissecting their testimony, refers to the missing critical link. Not that one, this one. All three, Baker, Gottlieb, and Evans, testified on the assumption that these three daughters had rejected the father. The court, the ultimate finder of fact, determined exactly the opposite, that these children never refused a visit, never refused access. Dad had 50% of the time, and they never missed a beat. In the Lincoln hearing, they spoke to the judge of their love for both of their parents, et cetera, et cetera. Were there tensions here and there? Sure. And the judge properly explained it because why? Two of them are teenagers. Of course there's going to be things that, you know, rules are imposed and they don't like it because they're coming into their autonomy and so forth. But when your expert goes in assuming a fact and then the court, as the true finder of fact, determines the opposite, that testimony is pretty much worthless at that point. The lack of evidence from the daughters cast the expert opinions into a nearly hypothetical context. Why is he saying that? Because these three experts who came in and branded mom an alienator gave specific opinions about the people in this case, even what's in the children's minds, never interviewed mom and never interviewed any of the three children, all right? Never interviewed any of the three children. This actually is something of ethical implication under the APA Ethical Principles and Code of Conduct. 901B says that they are not to provide opinions about psychological characteristics of individuals unless they've conducted an examination of the individual. The problem is 901C, which is suggesting that if they're only testifying about a record review, they don't need to have talked to people because they're not expressing opinions about the people. They're talking about the records that they reviewed and the methodology. That is sufficiently ambiguous that the Sharpies find the wiggle room in there to say, well, I fall under that exception, and that's why I can give that kind of testimony. And the fellow who was in charge of the ethics in the APA unit was in the process of possibly recommending amendments to that to make it more clear when he left APA and nothing seemed to come of it. But it's highly dubious. The missing link, the analytical gap. When the judge refers to the missing critical link, it really brings us right smack dab into the middle of the language of the Supreme Court opinion in General Electric versus Joyner, that a court may conclude that there is simply too great an analytical gap between the data and the opinion that is being proffered. Right? To give testimony, giving the opinion that mom has alienated the children, that she's an alienator, without ever having interviewed mom, without ever having interviewed the children, is an analytical gap. I mean, to say it's an analytical gap is like saying the Grand Canyon is a minor fissure, all right? It's a critical missing piece of the case. Great movie, Thelma and Louise. God bless them. Amy Baker was essentially the lead witness. She testified to her 17 special ingredients that add up to alienation. Coincidentally, the same number of ingredients that McDonald's uses in its French fries. Right? You know, you thought it was just potatoes, oil, and salt? No. Read the list sometime. You'll never eat another one. It's the other 14 ingredients that make them as tasty as they are lethal. All right? She goes through her list. These are what she calls the 17 alienation strategies, which she now tries to shoehorn this into this particular case. Bad-mouthing, limiting contact, interfering with communications, metaphorical removal of the father from the children's lives, such as removing all of the pictures of him from the family albums and things of that nature, withholding love anytime the kids express something positive about the father, sending the kids the message that their father doesn't love them, doesn't care about them, portraying the father as dangerous, communicating that the daughter's time with the father is discretionary, that they don't have to go with him, inciting the daughters to reject the father, keeping secrets, using the daughters to spy on the father. You know what her tenuous basis on that one was? That, remember, the kids are 50% of the time with dad. Dad has left mom, and dad's new love interest is a young woman who, until dad left mom, had been the children's nanny. All right? And they would come back and say to mom, blah, 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 and she would talk to them about it, and the judge said, it is inconceivable with children of that age that that would not become a topic of conversation, all right? Encouraging the daughters not to call their father dad, replacing the father in the daughter's lives with another father figure, changing the daughter's names, withholding information from father, undermining the father's authority. She testifies to all 17 strategies and how they mean parental alienation on mom's part in this case. The problem was as follows. Boom, the court's scorecard. On 14 of the 17, there was no evidence whatsoever of any of those things occurring in the case. And the three that did were of such equivocal, and don't get me wrong here, the mother's conduct was deplorable. And the mother did things in violation of the agreement that had been incorporated into the order. She wasn't faithful to getting medical information and things like that. She was held in contempt and fined a lot of money on the contempt finding. But those incidents did not in themselves add up to alienation. And by the court's count, on 13 of the other 13 allegations, there was either no evidence of that kind of conduct or there was no correlation between the alleged conduct and any impact on the kids' views of their father. All right. Now, Baker testifies as a researcher. So when she goes through these 17 strategies, as she calls them, she's basing that on research that she has done. And I'll put research in quotes. She has real deficiencies in that research. In fairness to her, she has acknowledged that. It's a very small group of people who she has interviewed. I think somewhere around 40 people. All right. The sample size is too small. There was no comparison group. She talked to people who said they experienced alienation during their childhood, who were now adults, and they talked to her about that. But she didn't interview other people who had gone through similar conduct who didn't feel the same way. In fact, some of them said to her, yeah, this is how I feel about it, but I have a brother or a sister or both who went through the same thing, and they feel exactly opposite. Would you like to talk to them? No, I wouldn't. No, I wouldn't. So you've got problems with the robustness of her research with respect to the size of the group, the lack of comparison group, and they were self-selected by ads that she put out on the internet asking people to contact her who would participate. So there's a certain process of self-selection going on there that would skew the data as well. Think about the structure of an expert opinion. Following the structure of logic, there has to be at least one major premise, one minor premise, put together through the reasoning process to get to the conclusion. The major premise must be expert knowledge, or you're not dealing with an expert opinion. This goes to the essence of what an expert opinion is. All right. They are using the knowledge contained in the metaphorical professional library of their discipline to explain what the case-specific information means. In this case, that so-called expert knowledge was based upon her own research. And as just noted, the research would be, I think, by most real researchers, regarded as deficient to warrant the conclusions that she has drawn. So that would be an area of attack. The other area of attack is on the minor premise case-specific data. All right? She made all of these assumptions about behaviors, and the court found that those things had not occurred. That's a concrete kind of attack. You know, you can attack on the major premise, and frankly, it's intellectually fascinating to do it. It's intellectually challenging to do it, to get into the research and the lack of generalizability or the lack of robustness and so forth. But depending on who your judge is, you might leave that judge, you know, hanging him or herself. All right. But you get into this witness assumed fact A to be this, when in fact the evidence shows it was that. Any judge is going to understand that. Those concrete attacks are typically going to be more effective in undermining the credibility of the testimony. Right? Gottlieb, the social worker. Oh, how I love social workers. Overconfident and arrogant. You got to get that out of your expert. You cannot put your expert on the stand with that kind of attitude. This is the court's language. She introduced her testimony by describing a book that she wrote about classic symptoms of alienation that, in her words, quote, were so classic that I began to know what the children were going to say before they said it. Can you imagine? Right. When asked about these three kids were real champs. I mean, these three kids were academic performers, extracurricular, excellent, all kinds of activities, love boat parents, tremendous grades. I mean, these are the kinds of kids any parents would want to have. And she's confronted with the fact that these kids are so well-adjusted and so forth, and asked about the seemingly well-adjusted and academically proficient children. Does that mean that they are doing well psychologically? Does she give the obvious? Well, sure. No, she says, no, unequivocally, no, absolutely not. She then went into a psychological dissertation, the court's words, over maladjusted children without any reference to the daughters in this case, all right? Her hyperbole, another practical lesson, you don't want your experts outrunning the data. You don't want them overreaching. You don't want them exaggerating. Court's language, her hyperbole in response to that question alone cast doubt about her entire testimony, all right? In response to various questions, the experts said the children were, they somewhat have contact with their father. Somewhat. He had them half the time. They never refused to go. He didn't lose any time because of any resistance or refusal on their part. And the most she's willing to concede is while, you know, somewhat have contact with their father. They had as much contact with him as with their mother. Another practical lesson. Your expert cannot sit on the stand and give testimony that's detached from the reality of the case.
Oil pan.
It brings to mind all of that consistent with nonsense testimony that you might get. Years ago, I was representing a father on a sexual abuse allegation. I was deposing the DSS worker. It was an allegation of fondling. The little girl was, you know, pre-verbal. The mother suspected that the father fondled her when they were sitting in the chair. Mother runs her to a pediatrician who examines her thoroughly and writes up a report and says there's no medical evidence whatsoever of any sexual abuse. Nonetheless, DSS proceeds and says it's found it and they're taking it to court. So I'm deposing her at a deposition. This is where you do ask the non-leading questions. You want to get them talking as much as possible. So I said, where's your evidence of sexual abuse that it occurred? She said, the pediatrician's report. I said, which pediatrician's report? Well, she said, there's only one. I said, yeah, there's only one. Is this the one? Have it marked, et cetera. Yeah. What is it on this report that you would point to that to you says there was sexual abuse? And so help me. She points to the section on the conclusion. And I said, please read that into the record. She reads it. I find no medical evidence whatsoever of sexual abuse. I said, so you're telling me that when you read that, that to you is evidence that sexual abuse occurred? Yes. I said, would you mind explaining that to me? And in that best disgusting, sing-songy, social work, condescending tone of voice, not that I have any strong feelings about this, she says, well, Mr. Tippins, if you knew anything about sexual abuse, you would know that it can occur without leaving any medical evidence. So when that doctor says there's no medical evidence, that's consistent with sexual abuse. I'm not kidding. I said, so let me make sure I understand this. I said, if I have a little baby here, year and a half old, in a bubble, let's call her bubble baby. And we've been watching her 24/7 for a year and a half, and she's never left the bubble, and nobody's been there to touch her. And now we take her to a pediatrician and we say, examine this baby and see if there's any evidence of sexual abuse. And the doctor examines bubble baby and says, there's no evidence of sexual abuse. You would say, aha, that's evidence of sexual abuse. Yes, that's correct. Thank you, ma'am. I'm glad I finally understand, you know? I mean, Gottlieb. The apex of foolishness. Harsh language for the court to use, right? Absolutely warranted. This witness testifies that one of the acts of alienation by the mother is that when she would say goodbye to the kids when they were going for their time with the dad, she said, oh my God, she'd say, I'm going to miss you. That was alienation in this witness's estimation. The judge said in the opinion, if that's alienation, then every mother on the planet Earth needs to be reprogrammed. I mean, just absolute foolishness. Evans, the third witness. Practical lesson. Make sure your witness is not going to get up there and try to bully the court or displace the court. This clown gets up there and he testifies that, judge, if you pay attention to what these kids tell you in the Lincoln hearing and you abide by their preferences, you'll be as guilty of alienation as the mother. Can you imagine that? And as the court said, that is not only far-fetched, but it's directly contrary to New York law. You don't want your witness getting up there with the attitudes or the words of attempting to displace the judge who is the ultimate arbiter of the facts in the case. The expert witness is not. And that kind of arrogance simply pushes the credibility down the drain. Peter Favero, testifying on behalf of the mother as a rebuttal witness, refutes their testimony by simply Semeia saying, you know, it's speculative and non-scientific. There was absolutely no basis for it. No basis at all. And that testimony certainly helped cinch the deal, shall we say. All right. So what the hell happened here? I mean, that's got to be a question rumbling around in Dad's mind. I've spent all that money on all of these experts, and holy mackerel, what happened? His experts just outran their data. They outran their data. They had absolutely no basis to support the opinions they were expressing about these people, particularly when they had no examination or interview or contact with these people. All right? Now, they didn't interview the kids and they didn't interview mom. Could they have? Answer, not really. All right? Can you imagine a custody judge, especially with Rosenblatt still on the books from 1985, can you imagine any custody judge who's going to direct that children in the case submit to interviews by a privately retained hired gun witness on the other side? No. They're not even going to direct that mom submit to dad's experts or vice versa. So they're not going to have the opportunity for that. Meaning what? Meaning there's no place for them? No, but they should have observed certain limits here, all right? Rather than give opinion testimony about these people and the conduct of these people when they had no basis to do so without examinations and so forth, they should have restricted their testimony to what we would call didactic or educative testimony. There's a lot of different research out there that speaks to these issues of alienation. They could come in legitimately, if the court permits it, and give general background information. This is what's in our metaphorical research library, Judge, that speak to these issues. And this has been recognized as legitimate by the Advisory Committee on the Federal Rules of Evidence. They have written, opinions are not indispensable in these experts, and we should encourage the use of expert testimony in non-opinion form when counsel believes the trier of fact can draw the necessary inferences for itself. So you bring them in and you provide that background information that may be useful to the court and not venture to give opinions that are without basis, which will lead to their credibility going down the drain on everything. And probably one witness, not three. All right. So, another point. Suzanne QQ versus Ben RR. I alluded to this morning. Family court did not, this is a decision from last year, third department. Family court did not abuse its discretion in precluding the father's proposed expert. The admissibility of expert testimony is generally a matter of discretion of the trial judge. Typically, those opinions are allowed only where the issue is somewhat esoteric and beyond the common knowledge of the fact finder. All right. In this case, the father offered to present a witness on parental alienation or parental alienation syndrome. As an aside, here again, this is the one I mentioned earlier. This is the second time that the appellate division throws in parental alienation or parental alienation syndrome. I'm not sure anybody down there understands the difference between those two things. In any event, the court discerns no error in the trial court's determination. Look at this. That it could consider whether the mother's actions amounted to parental alienation without expert testimony from an individual who had not met any members of the family because the court was familiar with the issue. Not everything requires expert testimony. Remember those cases I talked about earlier from 100 years ago? The courts were dealing with this problem by focusing on the behavior. All right. And a court sitting in these cases, if you present the evidence correctly, you present evidence that parent A told the children that parent B is an asshole, the judge does not need an expert to say that this was not good conduct, that this would tend to diminish the relationship with the other parent rather than enhance it. So don't assume you have to have expert testimony on all of these things. A lot of this stuff, judges, especially if they've been doing this kind of work for a number of years, probably have the background and can draw those inferences without us all getting bogged down in definitional controversies and so forth. And then finally, just a couple of hearsay issues, and then we'll get you out the door. Contrary to popular myth in many courtrooms, there is no general exception to the hearsay rule for statements by children. I have heard judges in trials say exactly anything the child said can come in. No, that's not true. There's no general exception for children's statements, all right? In custody cases, it is not unusual that we can get in a lot of things that the children say, not for the truth of their content, but as circumstantial evidence of the child's state of mind, all right? Special situations also exist. 1046A6 of the Family Court Act, Article 10, all right, allows out-of-court statements by children to come in as an exception to the hearsay rule for the truth of the content of the statement if they pertain to neglect or abuse. Not wholesale anything the kid said. Statements that pertain to either acts of neglect or acts of abuse are an exception to the hearsay rule in Article 10s. It also is applicable in Article 6 custody. It's also applicable in custody cases incidental to divorce. It is not, by the way, usable in Article 8 family offense proceedings. The cases have so held in the last few years. All right? So, there's a corroboration requirement. Yes, it comes in, the out-of-court statement comes in. Yes, it comes in for its truth as an exception to the hearsay rule. But a court may not predicate a finding on that out-of-court statement, on that hearsay statement, without sufficient corroboration. How much corroboration is required? Answer, not very much. Not very much. It's a pretty light lift. Some corroboration. Eyewitnesses, medical evidence, psychological testimony, cross-corroboration, two kids saying the same thing. But repetition is not corroboration. Kid says to mommy, daddy abused me, and then repeats it to the cop, and then repeats it to the doctor, and then repeats it to the social worker. That is not corroboration. Legions of cases say that. However, our beloved Third Department seems to be chipping away at that. Recent decision, last year, Corey O, while the mere repetition of an accusation does not by itself provide sufficient corroboration, some degree of corroboration can be found in the consistency of the out-of-court repetitions. You tell me how that differs from allowing repetition to be considered corroboration. It may not be there quite yet, but it sure as hell is an indication that they may be bumping toward the point where they're going to say repetition by the same kid of the same thing is corroboration. Another point, CPS reports, 241A. CPS investigates a claim of abuse or neglect. They come up, it's unfounded. Those records get sealed and they're inaccessible pursuant to the statute. But be aware of this case, DM versus JEM. The purpose of the sealing is to protect the person who was investigated and ultimately found not to have any sufficient evidence of having done anything wrong. But where that's the person who is asking for it to be unsealed because they want to put this in as evidence of a false allegation in support of their alienation claim, the court holds that would be a basis for ordering that they cough up that file. I have not found other cases saying the same thing. I have not found any appellate cases saying the opposite. So that seems to be all we have. It's a 2009 decision from Judge Kadish. And then finally, one last point. Out-of-court statements that are relevant per se are not hearsay. All right? And that comes into play in what we're talking about frequently. Words of alienation offered in a custody proceeding are words that are relevant per se, irrespective of the truth of the content. So, for example, mother is claiming that the father is attempting to alienate the daughter. Father says to his daughter, "Your mommy is a whore." A third party witness heard him say that. She is now on the stand, called there by the mother. All right? Even if the father doesn't believe it or the kids don't believe it or anything else, the hearsay objection would not be well-founded. It's not coming in for the truth. Mommy's not offering this to prove that she, in fact, is a whore, all right? She's offering it against him because it's relevant per se, and it would come in on that basis. Let me ask you, we'll end with this. Pop quiz. Is there another basis for admissibility? This is a statement by dad being offered into evidence by mom. All together now, boys and girls, what do we call that? Somebody said it. An admission. Exactly. Very, very good. Class dismissed. Hope you enjoyed the program and got something out of it. Thank you all very much for attending. We appreciate it. Drive safely. Well, like 3:55.